Okay, I'd like to wish you all a very warm good morning. A warm good morning because we have a furnace that burns oil or something like that. This morning I'd like to talk about peak oil. I'm going to talk about how the concept arose and briefly touch on some of the implications. It's the societal and spiritual implications that I hope to stress. So in effect, this is a homily about abundance and scarcity. In 1956, an oil geologist named Marion King Hubbert presented a paper to the American Petroleum Institute. The American Petroleum Institute is an openly pro-oil, non-profit conglomerate, and I mean that, they have dozens of offices, that tirelessly lobbies, propagandizes, and spins. It is where people who make their living from oil can go with a reasonable expectation that they will not have their worldview challenged. And thus it was that Mr. Hubbert's presentation that day must really have been a skunk at the picnic. For what he was presenting was a paper theorizing that on the basis of ease of extractability, not total reserves, which is a number that bounces up and down like a drunk man's fancy, but on the basis, not total reserves, but how easy it is to get the oil out of the ground, that the U.S. petroleum industry would start to measurably start to decline by 1970. And he hit his mark, probably within a couple of years. Since this prediction was in no distant future, but less than two decades, away, that wasn't good news for anybody there. Essentially, he was telling them that for the balance of their careers, they would be presiding over the decline of the extraction of oil in the U.S. Later on, he predicted that there would be a global peak oil, which we are supposed to have passed already, but I think actually we're a couple of years away from. And anyway, that, in a nutshell, that's what peak oil is. The demand curve, which grows every time a baby is born, meets a supply curve which is held in place by how difficult and expensive the remaining oil, which the oil companies say is limitless, can be extracted from the ground. To be fair, the concept of peak oil is a controversial one. And so let me be very clear that what I'm about to say is my opinion, having read as much evidence as I can. The oil companies all say that peak oil isn't true. Peak oil always has been and always will be a fallacy. They're very clear on that point. I'll let you think for a moment about the truthfulness, corporate responsibility, and peaceful history of oil companies. Just for a moment, give yourself an opportunity to think of three news items in which the oil companies have knowingly lied about something or killed workers because of safety violations. Shouldn't take you long to come up with three. Now ask yourself whether you would have any reason to believe the oil companies when their representatives say that peak oil is a fallacy. They are closest to the geological information which makes peak oil at least a working theory, and they've the most to lose if it's true. And they've lobbied like elite shock troops to be able to drill on every square inch of the planet if they choose. If peak oil is true, then citizens have a reason to prevent them from drilling. And if it's false, then anybody who stands in the way of drilling is impeding the orderly march of progress, which has unfolded on our planet since 1859, which was the first year that oil was drilled for in the United States, or anywhere for that matter. So from their perspective, they're right about peak oil. But they have to kill our mother. They have to kill Gaia to be proven correct. Drilling for oil cannot be made to be an environmentally friendly action. In my view, if the oil companies are denying peak oil, that fact and the evidence I've encountered is enough to convince me I should be concerned about how expensive my gas is. But how concerned should I be? Chicken Little didn't have a plan. And the fox went, achoo. How did we end up here? When the oil industry started up in the continental U.S., there was more supply than ability to extract and process oil. Getting oil out of the ground made a lot of money, and so more extraction and production capability was built, because everybody who had money to invest wanted some of that action. Demand grew, and so did supply. Hubbert figured out that all natural systems can be depleted, even oil, and started measuring oil production against demand. Eventually, he reasoned, there would come a time when the demand curve would hit the supply curve, not because there was no more oil, but because you couldn't get it out of the ground and to the customer without spending too much money to extract it. Which is why the dirtiest and most environmentally disastrous projects have been left so late in the development process, because the price of oil had to rise enough to make it worthwhile. That's why we have the tar sands. The oil companies have been looking around in desperation for means of increasing production. That is why fracking is such a big deal in domestic oil production right now. Only by increasing pressure on the remaining oil by pumping special fluid into the ground can the remaining oil be extracted. We don't really know what the long-term effects are, but it certainly isn't looking good for the people of Pennsylvania. And fracking is legal in BC, so the long-term consequences will be part of our children's heritage as well. We are all living in the shadow of this troublesome dearth of oil. The days of easy oil discovery and extraction are over. The last big discovery, does anybody know when the last big discovery was? 2003. It's almost a decade ago. It's only coming online now in Brazil, where the Brazilians have purchased their first nuclear-powered submarine to protect their new offshore wealth. Whatever future energy source humans use, the last 150 years of technological development would have been impossible without oil. To my mind, the little geopolitical stability we've had over the last century, and yes, there have been oil wars in the middle of that, but the little that we've had has been due to relatively inexpensive fossil fuel. At the same time, the lack of it threatens the way of life that we're used to. Up until this point, as a species, we've always counted on technology to help us find a way to escape the corner we've painted ourselves into. When the oil supply is restricted to those who can afford it or have the muscle to steal it, let's hope we get some relief from science. And we should be looking for some guidance about how we're supposed to run our lives. I can't be the only person in this room who's noticed that oil appears to cause war. That is one of the political implications. Where there is not a full-scale war going on, there's a war against the population sitting on the oil, whether they are the denizens of the sea, as happened in the Gulf, or Nigerians, as is happening in the Niger Delta right now, or the Beaver Lake Cree, who are also sitting on quite a bit of oil. Very powerful people want the last of the easy oil, and they are more than prepared to bribe and threaten and kill to get it, or hire the people to do work for them. It's very easy to look at oil and the impact that it's had on human life on this planet and think that it's evil. I look at it and see it as a mixed blessing, and as it becomes ever more expensive, I do believe that human beings and the markets we create together will become more creative about how we respond to our needs. Oil has been so cheap that it has become the solution to every problem. The chemicals derived from it make fertilizer, plastic, fabric, pesticides, ink, medical supplies, parachutes, telephones, antiseptics, deodorant, pantyhose, and the list goes on and on and on. It's not just the ability to put gas in our cars. If we're lucky enough to have one, it's not just the ability to put gas in our cars that's in jeopardy if we can't afford oil. Every aspect of human life would become more expensive, and that would cause a huge shift in how we would have to do things as a species. There is always the possibility that new technologies will save us. I'm certainly willing to believe that. Genetically tailored bacteria to turn waste plastic back into oil are not science fiction anymore, and a naturally occurring fungus from the Amazon has been shown to be able to degrade polypropylene back into its original components, which that news was announced just in the last 2 weeks. We may get our tails out of the crack yet. We can grow plants to turn into feedstock for fuel. As Canadians, we will have access to these technologies, and in fact, we're developing some of them. But whether we can elect governments who will make the unpopular choices that will be necessary to effect change is an open question. There is only so much that an individual can do about demand for oil. We need visionary leaders. And I don't think leaders of parties who win elections with robocalls are a good bet to lead us with sound technology policy. Enough ranting. I'm going to change the subject. I'm going to rant about something else. I'd like to take a detour and just say a word about feminism. But it is. Over the last century, women have striven to be able to control their own minds and bodies and achieved, at least in some countries, success. All of that's been on the back of cheap oil. Cheap oil has made domestic labor-saving devices and contraception, in my view, the two biggest contributors to female emancipation, possible. If there is no reasonable substitute for oil found, feminism may founder. Now that I've managed to horrify you with a vision of a labor-intensive and socially backward future, come on down, Republicans! Let's look at some upside. Supposing all of this crap is true, the oil runs out, and we get this slow slide into a not quite as technologically sophisticated world. Is there any upside? Monsanto and all the nasty agricultural monolith companies are completely dependent on cheap oil to make and distribute their products. They will end up being priced out of the market, especially when the global seed-saving movement stops being a small band of pioneers and starts being everybody. Instead of collecting Pokemons, kids will be collecting, labeling, and sharing seeds, and everyone around them will be happy they are doing it. Instead of spraying weeds, we'll be sending herds of goats to eat them, and then we'll eat the goats or their cheese. Instead of driving 10 miles, paying for parking, and joining 40,000 other people to see a band promoted by a multinational media company, we'll be walking to the end of the street to play music in each other's kitchens. So may it be, and sooner rather than later. Instead of being indoors watching television, we'll be outside gardening, beekeeping, looking after chickens, rabbits, and goats, and Tom Lunderville will never lack for people to help him pick blackberries. There will be public and private transportation everywhere, some of it horse-drawn, some steam-powered, some electric, some human-powered. Rich people will still have cars. You'll spend a lot less time getting dressed because you'll only have two or three good pieces of clothing. Rag rugs are coming back. Kids will be walking to school again. Kids will be obliged to help their families find and preserve food, and they'll know where their food comes from. They will know what every insect pest and plant disease looks like. You want joy? Try turning a bunch of toddlers loose and saying, if it looks like this, you can step on it. Woohoo! You will know your neighbors. One of your neighbors may have a shed full of tools to rent to you or loan to you or whatever. So you will get out of the habit of thinking you have to buy anything and into the habit of considering what you can trade. Manners are going to come back. If the pace of life slows down, there will be time for more ornament and more ceremony in life. We'll eat less and enjoy it more. We'll still have sugar, but it will be from beets and not corn, and it will be made locally. We'll still have cocoa and coffee and cinnamon. It'll be expensive, but we'll still have it. We'll still have beer and wine and soft drinks and ice cream and cooking oil, and it'll all be local. We'll be eating less wheat and a lot more barley and quinoa and oats. We will return to more natural rhythms of eating, sleeping, working, and celebrating. We'll have less interference during childbirth, and virtually all children will be nursed for at least 6 months. We'll still have good water in the lower mainland, and most of us will have cisterns. We won't be having freesias flown in for the centerpiece from South Africa, but we'll still have local cut flowers if we want them. In predicting all these things, I'm thinking of what positive outcomes that may arise. And I'll leave you with one last comment. Beacon will still be here. We may have to get creative about how we get everybody to church and home again, and we may have a wood stove instead of a furnace, and we may have to get our own power generation to run the sound system, but our community will be here for us. Out of all of this talk of scarcity, there is still an abundance to life and the human spirit, which is quite independent of oil. Kindness and hard work and self-sacrifice do not go out of fashion. The most important thing to remember whenever anybody says to you that something scary is on its way, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. This too shall pass. Our Mother Gaia has let us nurse at the breast of inexpensive oil for a long time, but even the most loving mother eventually weans her children. And it's time for all of us to think how we may walk more joyfully and more humbly upon the earth that is our only home. Blessed be.